fairly and thoroughly and properly, but then after they leave IED, they enter into another world that we can't seem to get our arms around.
Well, I mean, I think that's not unique to these types of complaints. I mean, I think right. that those are the issues that we were raising when it came to our ordinance changes. One of those changes are that we are to study timelines of the Bureau, as well as IPR and the Bureau, and study timelines and study what's ways that we can make shorten those timelines and have those processes be more efficient. And through the implementation process of the ordinance, that's one of the areas that we're studying, and we're working with the Bureau and the City Attorney's Office right now to address exactly that issue per the ordinance.
Okay, that's good. So we're working on that, mm-hmm. and we'll at some point hopefully have some recommendation right. to alter that existing right. process, or yep. at least have some kind of objective standards as to how complaints are handled once they leave IAD and go into the police bureaucracy.
Right, and the Bureau of Human Resources also is involved in that. And all of us are working together on the implementation of the ordinance just as
I'd like to point out one thing that this report did, and I didn't discuss it very much, and that some of these complaints were the result of the manner in which the police officer on the street dealt with the client in the first place. And those could be misinterpretations, but the manner that the police officer dealt with the client on the street is what causes some of the complaints to be made.
As is usual, Hank, you and I are of the same mind. I was my very next observation / question. You noted in the report on closer inspection, and you were talking about a bias-based complaint. On closer inspection, the officer's tone and style likely contributed to the complaint being filed. So I want to make first an observation. That's not an uncommon right. Characteristic of government in general in its interactions with employees. And let me give you an example so it doesn't appear as though I'm picking on one group of employees, that being police. I was assigned the Bureau of Development Services nearly 8 years ago, and the most common overarching complaint was not the time involved it took to get a permit through the process, was not the expense involved, but how people were treated by the employees. Right. So we actually hired a company that came in and set up a forum within which existing employees would interact with customers, and there was a two-way mirror behind which sat the professionals that were going to help us try to correct the problem, and managers. Managers who, up to that time, had completely denied that there was a problem. So they actually got to observe for a whole day the interactions of their employees with customers, and they walked out appalled, completely appalled. So that didn't result in discipline. What it resulted in was a training regimen that lasted a year, wherein we trained each employee in, for want of a better term, customer service, how you interact with people, how you treat people. And we said, you know, it was important for us to say, how you treat people really matters.
Right.
I mean, whether they get the permit or not, or whether they are upset with the price of the permit is one issue. How you talk to people, how you interact with people is important. So I noticed there's a theme in your report, which you just alluded to, Hank, that says basically that we might have a problem with how officers simply are interacting with people, not necessarily that they're doing anything that's racially biased or culturally biased, but they're being fair. They treat everybody that way. So again, understanding this is not within the scope of this report, do you have any observations on how we get our arms around that basic customer service training? Is there ongoing training that police officers go through? If so, do we need to tweak that?
There have been training going on with the police department on the cultural things. And I'm sure there are other things going on that I don't personally know about. I don't know.
Of course, I want to be real clear. I'm not talking about cultural training. I'm talking about how one interacts
with each other,
anybody, whether they are a white Christian, all Americans, quote unquote, or an African American who immigrated here from Nigeria. It's important how we treat both of those individuals, and we shouldn't treat people who are culturally different. A flag should not go up and we treat them different right. than anybody else. They should be we should treat everybody with dignity and respect. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how we can get to that.
Well, there's a few things. One, I do know that they do customer service training at the Bureau and have spent efforts on that. I know that my numbers, Derek is going to kill me for saying this, but I'm assuming, just based on what I've seen, it feels like the business card policy has really helped.
I was just going to follow up
with the complaints. Yeah. I don't have any data to prove it, and he gets upset when I say things without data. But I do feel like by looking at the complaints that that's really helped, because we used to get a lot of those complaints, and I haven't seen that many. So I do think that that's helpful. I am going to disagree slightly about what you said about the difference the way that we need to handle treating different people in our differences in our community. I do think that there needs to be education based on working in an intercultural competency. I believe that the training that IPR had was really eye-opening to all of us. I think that those kind of things are important. And the way that we've somewhat handled it in our limited way and through this report is, one, we really encourage these cases to go through mediation. I think mediation is the best way for both the community member as well as the officer to have a better education of how that interaction affected them and maybe where some of the source of the anger or frustration was. So I think we really encourage mediation in these cases because you can have that one-on-one training, if you will. There's training you can have in a room, on the 11th floor of the Justice Center, or you can actually have that one-on-one training with an individual and both go back to their communities and talk about what they've learned. I think mediation is a real tool in helping, bridge some of these gaps. There was one other thing I was going to say that was helpful in this, and now I've lost my train of thought. But but I do think that mediation is key for that.
Well, just to be clear, the only point I was trying to make was that when all else fails, I have found the one thing that bridges people throughout the world is dignity and respect, no matter who they are or where they're from. If you fall back on that, that will get you through a lot of interaction problems.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I actually remembered what I was going to say now because you've sparked my memory on that. The other way that I think we're trying to educate the community and the Bureau together is our outreach coordinator actually works with members of the Bureau to go into community groups. Community groups often request an officer to come in because they want to hear from the officer their perspective or be able to explain to the officer their community's perspective. And she's done a great job at finding officers who are great ambassadors for the Bureau, as well as educators when they go back to the Bureau as well and explain to their colleagues some of the things they've heard from the community. Commissioner Fritz's Community Police Relations Committee is also another area where they can have those kind of ongoing dialogues and discussion, and IPR and CRC are more involved than they have been in the past in that committee as well. So I do think education is a good way to bridge some of these gaps. So,
and my final point would be the issue you just raised, the business cards. So they have that policy has been implemented, and officers are handing them out without being requested at each stop, wherein they don't feel as though they are in some type of jeopardy, which was the exclusion that we gave.
We haven't done any official audit of it yet, but it appears that that's happening.
Yeah, that policy is in place.
That's the policy.
The policy is in place.
We've received no complaints that hasn't happened.
Well, we always receive. I mean, I can't say for sure that we haven't received a complaint. I mean, sometimes officers don't give the service that we expect. That's why IPR exists. So, but as a bureau.
We actually received some complaints that people were mystified as to the intent of an officer. Particularly when it was a male officer and a female subject.
Well, okay.
I'm not going to comment.
So from your knowledge, Commissioner Salzman, that the business card handing out is happening.
Oh, yeah. It started in June.
Well, I appreciate the report. Very well done. Thank you.
So if I might ask a couple of clarifying questions, and I think it's important to be clear that this report, the disparate treatment complaints, is from the Citizens Review Committee and Independent Review of Citizens. Mm-hmm. The other one we received last week, the Independent Police Review Annual Report, is a Bureau-sponsored report.
Bureau as in Police Bureau?
No, as in Auditor's Bureau and yes. the Independent Police
yes.
Review.
Right.
Right.
Right. Okay.
So, and could you just refresh my memory as to the time frame for when you did the study, when you looked at the data versus when you started writing up the report? What does your report cover? Which time frame?
I think we started reviewing the data back in
2007.
2007.
And you finished reviewing data and started writing the report when?
2009, about midway through 2009, at the same time that the mayor's racial profiling committee was going on.
Okay. Yeah. So that I think that's important to know.
And we also delayed somewhat to catch up with the Bureau's report that they were working on.
Right. So that's very helpful because some of the things that you're recommending we discussed last summer and
right.
implemented, for instance,
yes.
the business
that's
chart.
Right. Right.
So just to clarify, from the citizen's perspective after your independent review, you believe that as a whole, the independent police review function is working reasonably well given that there's bias in all of our society.
Yes.
The real effort here was the process. And we believe the process is working real well, especially in light of the training that took place as a result of our findings.
Good. Yeah. Thank you. That's very helpful. I did want to follow up on the issue of pretext stops and minority driver complaints. As I was looking at what's the appropriate City of Portland response to the law recently passed in Arizona, my understanding is that the state of Oregon's laws regarding stops of both pedestrians and drivers, while not explicitly allowing it like Arizona's, that there are other states that have more protection for citizens than Oregon's. Is that correct?
I can't give you real authority.
Yeah. Yes, there are
I think
other
so.
States.
Yeah.
Pretext stops in Oregon are legal.
Are legal.
As long as you have a violation that you could stop somebody on.
I think that's I appreciate you including it in the report, and I think that is something that we're going to want to focus on moving forward and looking at the 2011 legislature is what is the appropriate
right.
state law to make sure that our police are doing what we want them to do and that state law matches that. So right. I'd appreciate your ongoing.
I mean, I believe current Oregon state law prohibits officers from inquiring about immigration status.
Oh,
that's
yes.
correct.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Even
immigration status aside, skin color and other issues that mm-hmm. were covered in the report
right.
are of concern, I think, and I share that concern. So I greatly appreciate your report. And I also appreciate the auditor's annual report at the same time. Looking at the two together, I think is illustrative. I was particularly struck with the executive summary of the report, which reports on discipline, because I think there's sometimes an illusion that there is no discipline regardless of whether complaints are sustained or not. And in fact, the report says that 5 officers have been terminated over the past year, 26 resigned during the investigation, so it's a total of 31 officers who either resigned or were dismissed over the last 5 years. 9 received between 150 and 600 hours of suspension without pay, and 33, 10 to 149 hours of suspension without pay. So that's 77 officers over the last 5 years who had some significant discipline as a result of the independent review process. It's important to note that we don't want to shame particular persons, and we want people to have the opportunity to do the discipline and then do better. That's something that we value for our employees. At the same time, we want our citizens to know that, in fact, yes, there are consequences, that when complaints are found reasonable, that those discipline is imposed.
And we'll be back on June 30th at 2 o'clock to talk about the annual report.
that would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, including the specific recommendations mm-hmm. from the committee's project, I think, and helping us all understand how the two mesh is very helpful. I will be particularly interested to hear your recommendations for how the Office of Human Relations, the Human Rights Commission, the Community and Police Relations Committee can continue the work that was done in the Racial Profiling Committee and how we can help with those issues of trust. I think we're at a turning point thanks to many of the things that have happened and because of many of the tragic things that have happened, where we have a general recognition in our society that we want to do things differently. Commissioner Saltzman and I are working on the Bazelon project with Cascadia and multiple partners in the community, including the police bureau, and the sheriff's department, and Multnomah County and hospitals and others, in a three-year process to look at how do we better take care of people in the community who need help rather than law enforcement, and then how do we help the law enforcers given that they respond to emergencies no matter what the cause of the emergency, and we want to be able to help as well as investigate when things go badly and impose that discipline. So thank you very much for your good work.
Just one point of clarification about timelines for investigations.
Mm-hmm.
I thought in the ordinance we passed there was a 24-month timeline attached now from when a complaint's received to when an investigation must be brought to the police review committee.
I am sure in one of the versions that you saw there were specific timelines, but in the end what we ended up doing is having timelines be an area that we needed to further study and then come with recommendations to council.
So thank you for your work and your volunteer service on volunteer service and paid paid work on this very important aspect of accountability as it relates to the Bureau of Police. The number of cases that you reviewed was relatively small. And I just want to be clear, did this process contact the complainant, or was a review just a review of the write-ups?
We just did write-ups. We did not contact complainants.
And is there any place in the process for the overall process for individuals to propose specific improvements or solutions to sort of follow up on what Commissioner Leonard's line of inquiry? I want to fortify the continuous improvement in the police bureau. So how do we give folks that interact the opportunity, especially complainants, to give us their best suggestions on improvement?
Well, there are a number of different places where a citizen can make recommendations or be involved in this. And it occurs at every one of our regular meetings, of course. And now we're in the process of having, at least at this point, two community-based meetings held by the CRC where citizens are invited to participate. And there are, I'm sure, are other places where that can occur. Citizens are included in the work groups which are aside from the CRC where they can also participate. And,
yeah.
And the outreach program is another place where that occurs. And that occurs quite much more frequent than does the CRC work.
When it comes to complaints, we have a satisfaction survey that we send out to all complainants. Of course, as with most surveys, the response rate is very low. But there has been occasions where people have written things up, and I've had our outreach coordinator contact and have further conversation about it. We're also trying, it's been at least a year now, put appeal forms in the final disposition letters because we try and eliminate some of the barriers to appeal. And appeal is where really people are able to come to the CRC, come to these public meetings, and be able to, you know, talk about their case. And the CRC themselves are able to learn about the process, through the complaint process through the appeals.
Sure. And that sounds good, and I especially like that last note that you made. I just want to put out there again, though, asking folks for their ideas for improvement is I don't see that as robust as I would like to see it at a variety of different places along the way, including IPR and in the Bureau. I think it's really important that we have the opportunity to complain and need to and appeal and those kinds of customer service sort of when things go wrong. But I also want to make sure that we capture, you know, these folks that are having the hands-on, real-time, face-to-face experience and ask them for their ideas on how to solve some of the complaints that are brought up. I think we could capture more of that.
in our outreach coordinator, that position was vacant for over 19 months, and we really detailed that in our annual report, how much effort she has made to go into, you know, underrepresented communities, and the focus of her work, just like the focus of our investigators, is to listen and to return that information to us and to work with the Bureau.
But again, because I'm not hearing acknowledged yet, how can we improve? How can we solve that problem? What are your ideas? Those kinds of questions to folks that are interacting with the system, I think, would be of great resource to us.
One discussion we had was partnering with Portland State University to do a customer service survey of complainants. And we really haven't gotten that off the ground yet, but it's mm-hmm. something that we've been talking about doing, and I think it's something we need to do.
And also on the folks that were not dismissed, if we can be constantly, and I'm having these conversations with the Bureau, constantly asking everyone, you know, you might have been satisfied, but still, mm-hmm. how could we improve? How can we improve the process?
We actually have another small survey going right now on that, just that kind of question.
I think the business cards in part came out of, that was an idea somebody put forth.
Came from us, yeah.
So let's engage the public in that kind of solution making. Right. Any other discussion? Thank you all very much. We have testimony.
We have two people signed up, Dan Handelman and David Cox.
Good morning. Welcome to City Council. Glad you're here. You just need to give us your first and last name.
Okay, good morning, Mayor and City Council. A little under the weather, so excuse me. I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. Last year, Portland Cop Watch praised the Citizen Review Committee's bias-based policing work group for their interim report. But we'd hope that the final report, which is you're reading today, would include more community input and analysis of the CRC of former Chief Sizer's racial profiling plan and research into other community solutions to racial profiling. Today, we are continuing to express our appreciation for the valuable information in the report, but we're disappointed that only the first two of these elements were only partially included in the final report. We are strongly encouraged by the CRC's observation that the Bureau's racial profiling plan, unlike the CRC's report, did not address the so-called pretext stops. The fact that this report is being presented one day after information was released showing that Keaton Otis, an African-American man with mental health issues, was apparently stopped for pretextual reasons, probably racially profiled, and shot 23 times over what began as minor traffic infractions should be a clarion call to take this report to heart. That said, we support all the CRC's recommendations, even where we think the IPR and the Bureau can do even more. We also noticed that there are very low levels of sustained and insufficient evidence findings on these cases. This hasn't been talked about yet here today. The CRC called attention to the fact that none of the cases they reviewed resulted in a sustained complaint against the officers, not one. They also said the findings were more often labeled unfounded, which means the incident didn't occur the way the person described it, more than insufficient evidence, which is basically he said, she said. This is borne out by the IPR's annual reports, which show only one disparate treatment complaint was sustained in 8 years. It was in 2007. 42 were unfounded, 16 were found with insufficient evidence, and then 19 were called unproven, which is a new finding combining those last two categories. There are 8 allegations that were exonerated, meaning the officers acted within the Bureau policy. The CRC also noted that officers were alleged to have made rude comments after finding a person had no criminal history, revealed people's criminal records in order to embarrass them, and profiled people based on alleged gang clothing, which is likely compounded by their race. It's not clear to us that these behaviors have lessened, particularly with the HEAT team patting down hundreds of youth of color in operations targeting Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard and Lloyd Center and other areas frequented by African Americans. About the business card policy, it was a major achievement for City Council to direct the Bureau to hand out business cards at all stops, and thank you for that. And but the change directive now lacks the important caveat for officers who are asked to give a badge number to give their DPSST number that was in there. It was a hard-fought battle to get that in, and because officers used to say, I don't have a badge number. So I hope that gets put back in. And the final report repeats that the IPR prompted an internal, explains that the IPR prompted an Internal Affairs Division investigation by calling attention to repeated disparate treatment complaints against one officer. This explanation makes a great difference in transparency from the original report, which merely stated that the IPR director pointed out the officer's history, but now we know that the IED investigated because of the officer's history. And we have old comments from the draft report. If you have any questions about those, I'd be happy to answer them.
I don't get the significance of having the DPSST number if you have the officer's card and name.
Well, it's still a possibility that somebody might not hand out their card. And if somebody says, officer, I'd like your name and badge number, and the officer's response is, I don't have a badge number, then you're still stuck and they've acted inappropriately. I think even though I think that the director of the IPR even just said this, even though they're directed to hand out their business cards, it all stops now. It's not necessarily happening all the time. And
do you know that?
Well, we've heard anecdotal reports of that, but I can't prove it because people call us on our incident report line and say this happened, but we can't prove it. But we've actually seen a video where somebody went up to an officer and asked them for a business card, and they didn't give it to them right away. They had to ask a second time. They had to come back and ask a second time.
So to your last point regarding the Internal Affairs Division calling attention to repeated disparate treatment complaints against the same officer, that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm.
Just making sure that
Oh, yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. But the original report said the IPR director pointed out that this officer had multiple complaints, but it didn't say what happened. So, okay, so they made multiple complaints. What happened? Now we know the IED initiated an investigation. We also know that it wasn't probably sustained.
But they are tracking, and they're asking for that to be looked at.
It looks like it.
Which is a good thing. Thank you.
Other discussion? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Sir.
Mr. Mayor, I'm David Cox and members of the commission. I am a member or a resident of the Piedmont neighborhood and also a member of the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Decided to wear my hoodie this morning in solidarity with Otis, Mr. Otis, who is now deceased, and as well as the thousands of young people in our city who choose to wear dress like this because that's the style. It's incredible to me that that now becomes part of the profiling problem here. Discuss profiling today in light of the police version of the homicide of Keaton Otis, as Dan alluded to, released yesterday, is fortuitous to say the least. And it's not just racial profiling we're concerned about. In fact, all three of the latest police homicides, Aaron Campbell and Kent Keaton Otis, as young black males deemed quote-unquote bad guys by the police, and even Jack Dale Collins as a vagrant or unwanted drunk at the Hoyt Arboretum, were all profiled. Worse, in the Otis case, was this young black man being singled out as a, quote, looking like a gangster, unquote, according to the newspaper report this morning. So now officers of Portland have to be, now citizens, I'm sorry, of Portland, have to be afraid for their lives, not only for being young or a person of color, but also for how we dress. Will there now be a police-enforced dress code for Portland? Clearly, this is unacceptable, as is the continuing inappropriate use of excessive and deadly force by Portland police. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Really appreciate it. All right. Carla, this is a report. I will entertain a motion to approve, to accept.
So moved.
Second. So moved and seconded. Carla, can you please call the vote on item number 787?
Fish.
I want to thank Mary Beth Baptista, the auditor, and the CRC for a thorough and solid report on this subject and a very, I think, useful, productive discussion this morning. Thank you. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I'd like to thank the members of the Citizen Review Committee for their work on this important topic. I'd say an important topic and certainly a vexing topic. Any discussions about race in this country, in this city, in this state are always some of the most challenging conversations to have. But I think we have leadership at the City Council, leadership in the Portland Police Bureau, and through the IPR that are committed to making these conversations. And I should mention the Human Relations Commission, too. committed to making often uncomfortable conversations occur. I'm thinking in particular of the living room conversations that the Human Rights Commission convened, where officers actually meet in the living rooms with Latino families and talk about issues around community policing and race. And I also want to acknowledge the work of former Chief Rosie Sizer, who was one of only a handful of police chiefs in the nation to really acknowledge that racial profiling exists everywhere, including her own bureau. And she created an actual plan to address racial bias in the bureau. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that plan come forward, not to diminish the work that remains to be done. I believe Chief Reese will continue to want to build on Chief Sizer's work in this area, and I think we all do as a city council, too. Great report. Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, Michael Bingham and Hank Miggins, for coming down and for all of your work as citizens reviewing what the paid folks do, and you've done a magnificent job. It's very, very helpful for us to have an independent review of our independent review process, and that citizens have taken all this time to look into what goes on with support from the auditor's office. But this is your report, and I appreciate very much the diligence and knowing that more work, that work has been done since Mayor Beth Bautista took over the Office of Independent Police Review, since the Human Rights Commission and the Office of Human Relations took on the work of the Racial Profiling Committee. I second Commissioner Saltzman's comments regarding the great work that was done by Chief Sizer, and I also second his firm belief that Chief Reese will continue that good work. And so I'm looking forward to working with Chief Reese, with the Office of Human Relations and the Human Rights Commission on these issues. It takes all of us. And I also thank Dan Handelman coming in despite being sick and your ongoing comments. I'm glad to hear that some of the strategies that are in the report meet with your approval and with CopWatch's, and also thanking the folks in the police bureau who do look after us all day in, day out, and who, like us, want to make sure that everybody feels safe, that everybody is safe, and that we can move, as new Chief Reese has talked about, to them being peace officers, and that's definitely steps in the right directions. Thank you, Mayor Adams, for your ongoing support of safety and good policing in Portland. Aye.
Adams.
Well, again, thank you to the CRC for this very high-quality report and for its recommendations. Three things. One is there are so many initiatives going on in this area. As I take over as police commissioner, and I'm asking everyone to be a similar set of questions. One, help define for me what success is in terms of the scope of this review. You provided about a dozen points of improvement, although you found no significant racial bias in the IPR system. You also, I think, gave about a dozen points of improvement, which I like. It's part of we're doing good. How do we do better continuously? If I read over each of the points, some of them are more concrete than others, and I'd ask you to go back through, and I'm happy to give you some feedback through staff about, so what is success look like for that point? When will I know that the Bureau is doing what you recommended that they do? Some of these are clear, a few of them it's a little more nebulous, and I want to make sure that I'm an advocate for your points of improvement. And then again, just to reiterate, complaints are really important, good, and compliments are really important, but I want to start capturing the expertise that's out there in terms of solutions. And for example, Dan Handelman had in his a number of points that he thinks would be potential solutions on the issues that he covered. So we got to keep at that and collect that from the grassroots more. So thank you. Aye. Report is approved. We'll now take the item that was pulled from consent, Commissioner Fritz's item. Carla, can you please read emergency ordinance number 802?
Authorized grant agreements totaling $42,000 to the Neighborhood District Coalitions to administer grant funds for the Graffiti Abatement Community Grant Program.
Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. I pulled this item just to give a brief summary of the changes that we're making to the Graffiti Abatement Program as evidenced through this community grant program to let everybody in the community know that we want your help and we invite your help. The first graffiti database was designed in November 2003 and now contains more than 23,000 reports from more than 700 users. In 2009, 932 cases were reported to the Police Bureau, of which 67 cases were reviewed by the district attorney. About half of those were resolved. So your reporting of graffiti by taking the photograph and entering it on the graffiti hotline site really makes a difference, and we have been able to catch some of the perpetrators. And
you mean the phone app?
The what?
The phone app?
Yes, Mayor, I'm sure that's exactly what I mean. But no, there's other things as well. We will make sure that we get...
Just try to get a little love about the phone app.
The phone app. It's not in my script.
Sorry.
That's right. So that everybody knows, approximately 85% of graffiti is tagger graffiti, 12 to 13% is gang graffiti, and 1 to 2% communicative hate or political based. So much of it is sheer vandalism, and we need to make sure that it is taken down right away. That's the most effective way of dealing with graffiti, is for communities to take ownership of their neighborhood and to get rid of the offending vandalism. The Office of Neighborhood Involvement Graffiti Abatement Program has increased our focus on volunteer recruitment because we simply can't pay professionals. We don't have the resources to pay for the graffiti, although we do have a contract for the especially difficult to reach graffiti that would be dangerous for volunteers to get, so you please report those as well. These grants that we're considering today are divided up between coalitions. They're smaller than expected due to mid-year budget constraints, but we expect them to leverage more in human resources, and we encourage people to look at the Office of Neighborhood Involvement website and sign up to participate in a community graffiti abatement project. It's even more fun than pulling ivy. Mm-hmm. I know from personal experience. And these grants are intended to provide community building opportunities as well as address the graffiti abatement. When you take ownership of your neighborhood, and these projects may focus on different kinds of abatement, mural projects, as it's been shown that murals are less likely to be tagged than non-murals. The grants can be used for repair of an existing community mural, for protective coatings, for improvement projects such as planting, lighting, or other remodels to reduce the chances of graffiti, because it tends to be put up where it looks like people don't care, because the intent of the taggers is to have it up there for a while. So if you care and if you take it down, then they're going to move on somewhere else. You can also use the grants for graffiti cleanup supplies, paint solvents, power washers. There's all kinds of good stuff that actually works a lot more easily than just sheer elbow grease, although elbow grease is also very much needed. And business districts or neighborhoods can organize graffiti-free zones, and we've had several neighborhoods in North Portland and outer southeast who have been very successful in this project, and indeed individual volunteers who adopt a street and keep it clean of graffiti, and it's really wonderful. You can adopt a street or you can adopt a park bench and just take ownership of keeping that particular place graffiti-free. So please see the Office of Neighborhood Involvement website for details of how to sign up. There are several graffiti abatement work parties happening over the summer. I'll be participating in some of them, and we greatly appreciate the mayor for continuing to fund graffiti abatements both in this year's budget and in next year's budget. This is the creative way that we're hoping to leverage many more hands to make light work of getting rid of graffiti.
Thank you. Any additional discussion from council? Anyone wishes to testify on this matter? Carla, would you please call the vote?
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Thank you for highlighting this the great program, and certainly your enthusiasm for it is apparent. Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you. Aye.
Adams.
I have OECD when it comes to graffiti. It drives me insane, and I am really happy that you're on the job. Thank you. Aye. So approved. Can we read first item on the regular agenda, second reading actually, 803?
Authorize a grant agreement with Choose Local for $4,995 to publicize the benefits of the Portland Rewards credit card program to Portland residents, public schools, and businesses.
Please call the vote.
Fish?
This is a really good idea. Kudos to the mayor and his team for putting it together. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I put a link to this website on my blog of my website. I did it myself the very day that we had the hearing last week, went online. It's that no interest if you pay off the outstanding balance within 25 days, no annual fee, and all of the half of the profits of the card go to help these worthy programs. So thank you again for putting it together. Aye.
Adams.
Well, thanks to MapClix. That has been a locally owned business. Developing maps for neighborhood commercial districts across Portland for the past decade. Thanks to Unitas that is celebrating its 74th anniversary as a credit union that started out with the telegraph and telephone service here in Portland. And the Portland Schools Foundation and the County Sun School Program that will benefit. This is a good card for education. It's supports some local businesses, and for every dollar you spend at a local business, 84 cents stays in the economy versus 64 cents at a national chain. Aye. All right. Can you please, unless there's objection, please read the title for 804.
Accept a $20 million grant from the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Competitive Funding Program administered by the U.S. Department of Energy as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Yes, that is $20 million. The marching band was tied up today, so we are continuing this unless there's objection to June 9th. So continued. Can you please read second reading item number 805?
Create a local improvement district to construct street, sidewalk, and stormwater improvements from Gleason Street to 70 feet north of Davis Street in the Northeast 97th Avenue Green Street Local Improvement District.
Please call the vote.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Thanks to D. Walker for answering questions. Aye.
Adams.
Aye. 805 is approved. Can you please read the title for second reading, item number 806?
Authorize additional revenue bonds for Central East Side Urban Renewal Area.
Please call the vote.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I'm very supportive of the $2 million that is going to be authorized here to help support building a new Hooper Detox and a mental health crisis center. Great project. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
This has been in the works ever since I got on the council. I greatly appreciate Commissioner Saltzman and Mayor Adams for their ongoing support of the Hooper Detox Center and the mental health crisis center. It's greatly needed, and it will help us in our public safety. Aye.
Adams?
Well, this should have a marching band. It's been a great city, county, nonprofit, private sector partnership. Thank Commissioner Saltzman for his advocacy on this issue as well. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for 807?
Authorize continuation of the Chief Procurement Officer's signature authority for certain construction projects up to $5 million through June 30, 2011.
Where are y'all from? You're running to get out of here. Well, welcome to Portland City Hall. We're really glad you're here.
Thank you very much.
Study hard. That's right. Thank you.
We do.
You have a future in politics. This is objections. 807 is continued until June 9th. So moved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 808?
Authorize grant agreements with intergovernmental agreements with 15 nonprofit and public entities related to the Community Watershed Stewardship Program.
Commissioner Dan Saltzman.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm really pleased to bring forward this next item, the Community Watershed Stewardship Program grants, known as CWSP.
Really?
The Bureau of Environmental Services. Yes, really.
It has to be the worst acronym of the day.
Well, you know, we got to have acronyms in government here.
Yes.
The Bureau of Environmental Services, not BES, the Bureau of Environmental Services has been awarding these grants since 1995 to community groups doing watershed health projects like trail restoration or invasive species removal. It's a great program that's allowed people to take the work into their own hands and also to do the project together as a community. Over the years, the Community Watershed Stewardship Program staff has reached out to provide greater geographic and social equity in the distribution of these grants. And after last year's process, I asked the Bureau of Environmental Services to more explicitly include those equity components into the application process for these grants. I'm thrilled that several of this year's grant winners include equity pieces, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of that next year. And at this point, I'd like to introduce Bureau of Environmental Services Director Dean Marriott.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Mayor, members of the Council. I'm Dean Marriott, Environmental Services Director. I'm really just here to introduce our speakers, Kate Carone and Bridger Weinman, who will be presenting a brief report on the past 15 years of this program and what it has led to. They're both grad students at Portland State University, have been working with us on this project. I also want to introduce Jennifer Devlin, who's in the front row, and when I get up, I'm going to ask her to come up here and sit with the team because she's been a real integral part of the success of this program for the past 7 years. Although she's our environmental program coordinator for Fano Tryon Watershed, she does this work throughout the city. I also want to just take a moment to say that when this effort began about 15 years ago, it was considerably smaller. And over the years, it has grown in size and scope. And I want to particularly thank Mayor Adams for when he was environmental commissioner, encouraged us to double the size of the program, and we did so with his support. Just over the last 15 years, we have invested about $800,000 in community watershed stewardship programs. By our calculation, the community has leveraged that to the tune of about $2.5 million with their volunteer efforts, time, and it really has proven to be an enormously successful effort. It has engaged our citizens in caring about the watersheds they live in and caring about the community they live in, and has produced some measurable results. I also want to just point out that this is also a true partnership with Portland State University. We have worked with Portland State since the beginning on this, and I want to thank Professor Barry Messer for his good work in helping us make this a success. You may recall we were here a couple of years ago to indicate that the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Foundation had recognized both Portland State and the City of Portland Environmental Services for the national success that they wanted to highlight. So it's a nationally recognized effort, and with that, I will turn it over to our distinguished colleagues and ask Jennifer to come up. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Again, I'm Kate Carone, and this is Bridger Weinman, and we're the Master of Urban and Regional Planning Program at PSU. And we do have a PowerPoint, so I don't know how we can show that, but so as Dean mentioned, we're here to provide a short overview of the 15-year-old QUSP program to highlight programmatic changes implemented to include explicit equity criteria as requested by Commissioner Saltzman's office and to introduce the grant projects for the 2010-2011 funding cycle. So in the early years of QUSP grants, watershed funds were typically awarded to areas that still have streams because streams are a logical place for the community to come together. You can kind of see how they cluster around stream areas on this map. Since most of the open channels are in the Fano, Tryon, Westside Willamette, and also the Johnson Creek watersheds, many of the grants were awarded in clusters in those areas. And education and restoration projects comprised the majority of grants from the first program year, 1995, through 1998. But as stormwater retrofits like eco-roofs and bioswales became more common, QUSP began receiving requests in 1999 to fund stormwater projects. And this is really important because impervious surfaces are found throughout the city, which means that stormwater projects provide communities in more urban areas with really great opportunities to get involved and have projects.
So in 2003, BES began a concerted effort to distribute funds equitably across the city's watersheds to provide outreach to communities of faith and to provide grant writing workshops in areas that were underrepresented in our program. Also, since stormwater projects are more complex, BES added more technical assistance for grantees through the Clean River Rewards Program. This helps community groups with planning and permitting.
Excuse me.
However, with over 183 grants awarded, it's easy to see that some areas of Portland are still underserved, particularly outer southeast and parts of northeast Portland. So this is all of our projects through 2012. A quantitative spatial analysis confirms that some areas could use some extra assistance. At Portland State, my colleague Matt Rohrbach and myself prepared a GIS analysis of the spatial distribution of CWSP-funded projects. This map identifies target areas based on the distribution of CWSP grant funding and access to open space. In examining the demographic characteristics of these areas, we found that neighborhoods in outer East Portland, like Cully, Rose City Park, Roseway, Russell, Glenfair, Hazelwood, Summer, Mill Park, and the Powellhurst-Gilbert neighborhoods could especially benefit from targeted outreach for technical and grant writing assistance. In 2010, at the request of Commissioner Saltzman's office, a question was included in the grant application to allow applicants to state whether they are working with underserved populations. Also, a prompt was included in ranking materials for grant selection committee members to add value to the evaluation scores given groups that serve underserved communities. Also in 2010, we identified groups in need of additional technical assistance. While underserved groups have great ideas, often they need support in grant writing, project development, or partner recruitment. To address these needs, an additional PSU intern was added to the CWSP team to help groups develop proposals. He's actually distributing mulch here. This intern is also coordinating summer outreach at both the North Portland and Outer Southeast Portland Sunday Parkways to celebrate the 15th anniversary of CWSP and to provide information to people in areas that are underserved by our grants. In 2011, CWSP plans to include a grant selection committee member who has a strong background in equity issues.
So we recently completed this year's grant selection process, and here is the list of the 15 projects that are recommended for 2010-2011 CWSP funding. Projects highlighted in blue identified in their applications as serving underrepresented communities, as they defined the term, as applicants defined the term. And as you can see, 6 out of the 15 projects include an equity component. So I'm just going to go through a few of these to give you an idea of the kind of work they're doing and how they're defining equity. The first one that I'll touch on is Glenfair Church Community Garden. Located at East Burnside and 143rd Avenue in the Hazelwood Glenfair neighborhoods, the church plans to install a community garden on its grounds, on its private grounds. Their application identifies the surrounding community as economically challenged and culturally diverse, with about 75% of residents living in multifamily units without access to garden space. Glenfair Church will provide garden space to neighborhood residents. The church will grow food for snow-capped social services, and Glenfair School will develop a children's educational garden on site as well. The next project, ERCO Gilbert Park School Native Garden. ERCO manages the Gilbert Park Sun School in Powellhurst Gilbert in outer southeast Portland, and they'll use grant funds to engage students, teachers, and hopefully some parents in removing grass and installing an educational native garden. As you probably know, 76.3% of David Douglas School District students qualify for free or reduced lunches. And since annexation in 1995, this area has seen dramatic increase in low-income Asian, Latino, and Slavic immigrant, as well as mainstream families. So ERCO hopes that this environmental demonstration project will encourage neighborhood engagement, ownership, and pride. The last one I'll touch on is the Lent Springwater Restoration Project, Habitat Restoration Project. Some of you are probably familiar with Ed Kearns, who has been leading restoration efforts in Lent's neighborhood along the Springwater Corridor for the past 14 years. To date, Ed has engaged more than 3,500 students and 1,000 adults in more than 100 planting events. And this year, he is focusing his efforts at high-visibility intersections along the corridor between 82nd and 103rd. And he'll continue working with students this year from Kelly Elementary and, hopefully, Marshall High School. So in total, 40% of projects recommended for funding include equity components, and 67% of equity-containing projects that applied were approved conditionally for pending for funding. We also attempt to distribute funds throughout all of Portland's watersheds, although this year we received fewer applications from the Columbia Slough watershed. So each year, CWSP grows more competitive as demand for grant funding increases along with environmental awareness and engagement, which is a good thing. But as we navigate this more competitive landscape, it will be essential that CWSP continue to intentionally pursue equitable grant distribution. So thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Great presentation. Thank you.
Did you want to add anything, Jennifer? Or?
No, just if you have any questions.
I have a couple brief questions, Mayor.
Sure.
First of all, on the grant committee, do you currently have someone from Portland Parks and Rec who is engaged in the process?
Yes. So what we have is not on the committee, but before the grants get to the committee level, anything that involves a park goes through different park staff. For example, Leslie Poole Cosbo reviewed the one that we funded for Glenfair Church, even though they're not signing up to be part of her program, but just so that she knows about the community garden that they proposed there. So we have a very long, maybe it's about 25 different people in the city and outside the city who are on a committee. They're not really a committee because they don't meet, but it's called the Red Flag Review Group. And they're usually the landowner that somebody's proposing. I mean, we like to get a letter from the landowner that says it's okay. I'm sorry.
Where are y'all from?
Where are you from, kids?
Banks.
Banks. Banks Elementary or High School? Really? I hear the kids from Banks are really smart. Is that true?
Yeah.
Okay, and that you study really hard. And you do almost everything your teachers tell you.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, we're glad you're here, all right? Enjoy.
So you have a...
That was the quietest group that I've ever heard come through here.
And you said quite a number.
So, exactly. Right, so anything that's going on in parks, well, typically, what we really try to get grantees to call us and talk to us beforehand so we can connect them up to the right parks person. But even so, even if they have had that connection and that discussion and the parks person has included a letter with their grant, the parks person still reviews their grant because sometimes there's elements that are added or changed a little bit. So parks does review the grants.
Second question is, I think the framework of equity is extremely important and the geographic distribution. But do you have target goals for different kinds of things like the community gardens? Do you try to put, 20% of the dollars into those, or is it simply a function of what kind of applications you get and the quality of those applications?
We never have any idea what sort of wacky things people are going to be proposing each year. And we are really surprised by the different things that people come up with. I don't think we could have predicted a few years ago that we would have Depave, for example, proposing all these just straight-up depaving. So we've never set goals where we would have a certain number of stream restoration or a certain number of church parking lots or anything like that. It's intriguing, but they're usually a pretty diverse group that we fund, and we can get you, we could take a look at that if that's interesting.
But it might be a conversation that I'll have with my colleague about just aspirational things, because
sure,
there's some interesting overlays with commitments we've made through the Climate Action Plan categories, mm-hmm, of goals. But my final question is, I was struck by the numbers, and we operate on some rules of thumb in terms of the cost of doing a community garden. And it can range from $30,000 to $60,000 depending on the size and some of the challenges. And there are a couple of grants here for gardens, $4,000 as a low and $9,000. So what do you get for that investment?
Again, it's really variable. Some of the gardens are one of the gardens, for example, is an already existing garden, and what they want to do with the $4,000 might be remove some more parking lot and expand the garden. Or they might want to put in a new hose bib or, you know, something like that. Or they might want to haul in soil. So it's not like we're just getting a brand new garden for each one. The one at the Glenfair Church is, it's already, it's a grass area. And so they don't have to depave anything. They don't really have to do a lot of soil amendment. So it's a less expensive process. So they want materials to build a shed and materials to fence it off, and they want raised bed. They want soil, you know, to add to that one. So it's not as expensive as a process. They have really great partners that were gathered